We are in a pretty crazy moment in our country right now, following yesterday's historic vote to impeach President Donald Trump. On a news week like this, we check for updates minute by minute, hour by hour. But locally and nationally, this moment is a culmination of years of culture, discourse, economics, and yes, politics. And in the midst of this all-consuming political story, we're also approaching the turn of a decade, which is such a natural time to look back and take stock. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's what we're going to do today on KCUR's Central Standard. We're seeing lists galore from national media outlets, the books that defined the decade, the movies that defined the decade, the technological advances that defined the decade. So what defined the decade here? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. We have some in-studio guests this morning. They'll offer ideas of their own. Maria Carter is the news director here at KCUR. She started the decade as our morning newscaster, and she'll be our expert in news of the decade. Hi, Maria.
Hi, I'm glad that I get to wake up at a more normal hour now at the end of the decade.
Are you going to cite my current cold as one of the defining moments of the decade?
No.
I feel like we should acknowledge that as a big deal.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is a big deal. We'll get to it.
Okay. Carla Deal is the editor of a journal all about sense of history and place in Kansas City. It's called Squeezebox City. She runs an artsy literary venue called Squeezebox Theater, and she just wrote a book about Kansas City's debaucherous past. She will be our literary expert. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Gina.
And last but not least, Blair Schulman. He's an art critic for lots of different outlets, a curator at large, and he's best known for the Informality blog. He'll be our art and culture and architecture expert.
Hi,
Blair.
Good morning.
Okay, so you guys, can we just get one thing? I don't want to say out of the way, but it is a big deal, and it's the obvious thing to talk about, and I want to do it right out of the gate. The Royals won the World Series. Can we hear what that sounded like, please, just to relive it?
The 1-2 again. Inside the tower. The Royals, 2015 World Champions.
Maria Carter, talk to me about this moment and what it meant for the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think as much as this is a sports moment for Kansas City, it was a real turning point in my mind for Kansas City in the decade and, you know, maybe even before the decade of, you know, the Royals hadn't been, you know, good in a long, long time, almost since they won their last World Series. And you know, Kansas City, I think, maybe had mirrored its sports teams in some ways that it viewed itself, even if it shouldn't have. And to me, the Royals, you know, first going to the World Series a year before and then winning in 2015 was, you know, you started seeing everyone wearing, you know, those KC shirts with the Charlie Pride shirts with the heart and, you know, and just taking pride in being from Kansas City. And I think starting to recognize that, hey, it's not just the Royals. This is a good place to live. And there are a lot of cool things going on here.
Cool things to be proud of. You know, yeah. I also feel like the whole mood and outlook of the city changed. And I especially remember this moment when I read a letter from then Mayor Sly James. He had written an open letter on behalf of Kansas City that was published online. I don't even remember in what outlet. But it said something like, you hear that sound, it's the sound of Kansas City pulling up its chair at the table of world-class cities. I cried when I read that. I'm not, like, super proud of that, I guess, but, you know, and my husband laughed at me, but I cried when I read that because it felt so real and so true.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear everyone else on this a little bit, but,
yeah.
You know, Kansas City, I think, is very Midwestern in many ways mm-hmm. of, you know, even if we're like, yeah, we're pretty good, we're not braggarts, you know, right. We're not going to be like, hey, Chicago, actually, we've got it going on.
And we weren't braggarts until the World Series.
But I think that was our moment that we could, you know, it's like, there's no arguing this. We're the best on, you know, in baseball at the moment. And that, you know, it gave us a chance to shine and to let other people see Kansas right. City.
It was a great moment of civic pride for the city. And Kansas City's had quite a few of those over the last 10 years. It's been pretty great. But that moment, and I'm not even a huge sports fan. I remember watching the game and I just like ran outside and everybody else ran outside. So it's one of those moments where the whole city got together. And then the big...
Got out of their houses,
yeah. And the big to-do at Union Station, yeah. Oh my gosh, that was insane. But it's one of those things that really made you think, Kansas City's a great place to be.
Yeah, I want to chime in too and say I'm not a sports person either, but that moment was extraordinary. And I found myself getting caught up in that parade, and I was there, and I was, you know, tears in my eyes. And even, you know, my family's a big KC Chiefs fans, and they go every single Sunday. And when they allow me to attend with them, every time and they stand up and sing the national anthem, and there's something that happens when everybody's together and everybody's so gathered around one certain element of pride about our city. It's just kind of overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You can't deny that.
I do want to say, Carla, as a person who deals in narrative, I do think that making it in 2014 and then not winning it and then going back the second year and winning it, that gave this narrative just like an extra oomph. You know, that win was bigger than just the win of the year. It was the win of like, it was a win deferred and then gained.
Absolutely. And I don't think we've lost any momentum, I mean, across the city from that in our general mentality. I mean, I think we're all just really still excited to be here and excited to continue mm-hmm. to create a better city.
The city's definitely on an upswing, and it's continuing, and it's good to see. And I think there's a lot more cohesion.
Well, Maria, I do want to talk about politics. It is the day, as I mentioned, after a historic impeachment vote on the national level, one of the moments that you put on your list for what defined the decade in Kansas City was the 2016 election. I was surprised to see that on a list defining Kansas City in the decade.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a couple things happened that both, I mean, it was really my way to cheat some extra things onto the list all at once.
Because we did ask for top five.
But, you know, yeah, I think it was a defining moment in a lot of ways for our nation, but for Kansas City and, you know, both Kansas and Missouri in some particular ways. And I think, you know, one of them is in Missouri, we saw Eric Greitens elected to the governor's office. But as part of that, there were a lot of very conservative Republicans elected to the Missouri House and Senate. And, you know, and kind of a shift in things. And to me, having lived through Greitens, you know, near impeachment, he resigned, you know, but it felt very much like, you know, when I'm thinking about impeachment now, a little bit of a microcosm of this, not of the national situation. And it's very different in many ways, but, you know, just the fact that an outsider coming into kind of the top office and some, you know, like he does business in a different way. And I think you can draw a lot of parallels. There are many, many differences, and I'm not equating the two. But I think a lot of things happened there. On the Kansas side, I think particularly for Johnson County, you saw Johnson County getting a lot bluer, you know, a lot more Democratic. And then that played out in the 2018 elections as, you know, Laura Kelly was elected, Sharice Davids was elected, more Democrats were kind of elected from Johnson County to the state seats. So I think it was a pivotal moment in a lot of ways, kind of a reddening of Missouri and, you know, Kansas getting a little bluer, especially in our area.
And people have called it the purpling of Kansas, in fact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So call 816-235-2888 to join this discussion about what defined the last decade in Kansas City. Let's turn our lens to the arts. Blair Shulman, generally speaking, I think many of us always knew we had a special art scene in Kansas City, but the past decade seemed to be when the whole city kind of started to recognize it to some extent.
I think so. And I think the shift in architecture, the look of Kansas City, has helped reflect how the arts in Kansas City have changed as well. I think some of the more interesting art events that have happened in Kansas City, I think first and foremost, the 30 American show that just closed at the Nelson Atkins, a traveling show about the African-American life, history, and society. But the best part about it is that each iteration in each city had a different advisory board that got to select work from the Rubel family collection. And you got to see what was important in terms of the art displayed from the people in Kansas City. I mean, myself, I'm a sucker slash student for Jean-Michel Basquiat, and there was great work. Micheline Thomas and Hank Willis Thomas and Rashid Johnson are favorites of mine. It was just one of those powerful shows that kind of knocks people on their backside and said, this is a real big moment, and that it's not
that
only
Kansas City got to participate in this national conversation.
Kansas City is participating in a lot of national conversations, and even though I'm naming 30 Americans, I think a lot of work at the Kemper Museum and Erin DeZizek is doing a great work. I mean, the Hugh Locke Show right now, They had a Rashid Johnson solo exhibition there a couple of years ago that was just insanely great. So I think on
that was the one with the plants and things suspended. It was the
including gigantic
an organ.
It was something organ. I forgot the name of the title. Thanks for putting me on the spot, Gina. Antoine's organ. I did remember it, and it was this gigantic kind of a terrarium, and it was just this beautiful, beautiful thing. And going into the Kemper and into the Nelson, you get to see how pretty outstanding our museums are. And I have to include the Nerman Museum in Johnson County, which is just Bruce Hartman running the show out there. Just phenomenal work at all three major museums. We are very, very lucky. But that's on the bigger scale. Smaller,
Blair, can I jump in?
Yes.
Because I feel like I do want to start with the things that most of our listeners, if not all of our listeners, mm-hmm. will be able to have some sort of touch point with. So I want to start actually with, you put an architectural firm.
I did.
And it's Stamp on the City at the very top of your
list. Right. Well, it is. El Dorado Architects. I believe that they have been a force in creating this modern perspective for Kansas City. When you see photos of Kansas City, you see a lot of work by El Dorado. But the thing for myself, they've been instrumental in finally eliminating that Cowtown moniker that, as a transplant, kind of drove me crazy.
I'm not even a transplant.
Yeah, their incorporation of including artists and curators, including Hesse McGraw, who we have lost for a second time to go to Houston.
They always come back.
And artist Jim Woodfill, who is doing great work right now. He has a great show at Weinberger Fine Art right now. They've established a tone that addresses Kansas City in this interactive and approachable context. One of the big things that El Dorado has done is kind of introduced this idea of the green roof. There are a lot of newly designed and renovated spaces that have an outdoor green space that is more environmentally sound and friendlier and brings people together. The TWA building in the Crossroads has it. They did something downtown called Prairie Logic, where they used the 1% for Arts to bring in this boxcar, and there was this entire roof that must have been an acre of roof where all these people could just go, and it was like being on the prairie. And it was kind of outrageous that the audacity that El Dorado would want to do something like this to bring the prairie into downtown.
I want to say, I have mentioned this a few times over the years, but my first interview ever with a member of El Dorado Architects was with David Dowell, and it was in the early 2000s. So this is going on two decades now. But he talked at that point about the potential of Kansas City and that he was getting tired of people talking about the potential. He wanted, it's time to make it a reality. And I feel like the decade of their work that you're talking about mm-hmm. is really that shift from potential to reality.
I agree. I think people are letting go of any misgivings or fears that they might have about what the city can do, and they are doing it. And I think because of that, it allowed us, for my second choice, is the Kauffman Center, that someone like Moshe Safdie wanted to come and design something stupendous. And now when you see, there's lots of publications listing Kansas City as destinations. No longer are we a flyover city. And almost always they have a picture of the Kauffman Center. And it's immediately been established as a go-to space for performing art and music. And they're also my neighbor. I live in the neighborhood. It's very welcoming and friendly. It's very walkable. And people call it all kinds of things. For myself, it looks like a moon rising from the horizon.
It's so funny to me. I had to go back and check the year that this opened, because when I read this on your list, I thought, it was this decade? It feels such a part of the city by now.
It is. It is. And I think that was the whole point, was for Safdie to design something that would integrate immediately into the city. Although it's had an effect on the immediacy of the Crossroads and the DIY aspect of the art gallery scene in the Crossroads, it still nonetheless has incorporated this idea that culture in Kansas City is a real thing and is viable and fruitful.
Yeah, do you think it's changed people's relationships with the ballet, with the symphony, with the opera?
People are going, yes. I wish it was a little less expensive to go, but there are ways around that. But yes, a lot of people are going, and there are a lot of great and interesting cultural activities that are taking place, not only at the Kauffman, but at other places, at the Rep and all those places around the city.
We'll have some future conversation on the ways around that ticket price. Carla, Carla Deal, tell me what tops your list. What you are calling big moments are generally a little more under the radar, but I think that that's also worth taking into account, that the big things for everybody might not include everything that was a big thing in your community or within your frame of reference.
So my list really reflected what I thought the kind of heart of the literary scene was in Kansas City. So I really wanted to show some of the actual writers who were just working day in and day out and the good quality content that they're creating, and also certain events that have happened that I think will have a lasting impact on our city as a literary city. My number one choice just happened in November, but it was unavoidable for me to talk about because I think its impact on the city is going to be profound. It was the partnership between UMKC's MFA program, the Friends of the Kansas City Public Library, and the Kansas City Public Library came together to do a Writers for Readers event. It grossed $45,000 toward its goal of creating a literary book festival in the city and a book award, which I think we absolutely need if we're going to rise to the ranks as a literary city.
You mentioned the MFA program at UMKC, and that, I believe, is new within the last decade as well.
I actually was the graduate of the first year that they did that, and I came to the city for that. So I have my MFA in creative writing from UMKC, so I've been a longtime supporter and also kind of helped cultivate that that environment there. And I am still very connected to all of my professors, all of the writers that came out of that.
That was a next step that didn't exist for writers in Kansas City before that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the benefit of that and the way that everybody still stays connected, it makes me feel glad to live in a city that is small enough to where everybody can still be supportive of each other, but big enough to bring in these big-time writers and authors and even have them as, you know, professors within the program.
So what – if you get to pick one more for now of your list, what will you share? You'll share more later.
So I really want to highlight a group of writers who came to a collective known as Friend Dog Studios. They are Brian Huther, Ben Oksher, and Seth Mackey, and they're the funniest guys you'll know. Their content has gone viral. They've had millions, like 8 million views of their online content. They had drunk Trump videos that were hilarious. They did a GOP Jesus. They did a 2016 movie trailer that was never to be made into a movie. These guys talk about the national and international culture, but through a very Midwestern heart and soul. And if you find yourself on their YouTube channel, you will not be disappointed.
We will get right back to our panel and to you in our look back on the decade, Kansas City style. 816-235-2888 is the number to call if you want to join us or tweet your ideas at KCURCST. The big moments that defined Kansas City in the teens, the tens, we'll talk about that too. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about the last decade of life in Kansas City. I feel like we should call the decade something like the teens or the 20-teens, to be decided in a moment. My guests are KCUR's own Maria Carter, Carla Deal of Squeezebox City. She's also the author of a book called Storied and Scandalous about Kansas City's past, and art critic Blair Schulman. Hi again, you guys.
Hello.
Hey.
What do we call the decade we've been talking about?
I think the teens is okay.
The teens.
Yeah.
The 20 teens.
So if these are our teens, we're kind of like an adolescence and can't be held accountable fully.
It's the TikTok decade.
Okay. We're coming into our own. We're coming of age, Kansas City.
Yes, we are.
All right. We have a call from Peregrine, and I'm guessing that this is Peregrine Honig because I don't know a lot of other Peregrines out there. Hi, Peregrine.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Peregrine.
What are you seeing as a big moment for Kansas City in the last decade?
It's pretty recent, but I was so excited to find out that KC Klopp had organized getting the Tivoli Theater into the Nelson Action.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if we're looking at it from a decade standpoint, I would say that we can't talk about the Nelson embracing the Tivoli without also talking about just the fact that it closed to begin with and that so many other movie theaters in town did close.
Absolutely, and it's such an important history in our city. I know you were friends with Bob, and it's such a great sort of renaissance to acknowledge the history of film and also all of these young filmmakers in Kansas City, it just gives us everyone a platform and everyone a space to experience that form of art.
Well, thank you, Peregrine, for that call. Any thoughts from our panel here on the story of the Tivoli and its arc over the last decade?
Well, again, it's the demise of the weirdness that has dominated the art community for such a long time is now become kind of mainstream and therefore is easily dilutable. So you would go to the Tivoli and see all kinds of strange events, and that was the joy, is that you kind of didn't know what was going to happen. So to see it in a new iteration at the Nelson is going to be kind of great. I'm looking forward to attending.
That it's less of a secret of an in-the-know crowd, and it's more of part of the big institutions that the city sort of, on a pretty formal level, has this artistic side.
That's right. Yeah, it was kind of like going to it was like an experimental movie theater where if you were a local filmmaker, you had an opportunity to show your film to a regular audience. It was a single screen theater, which was another thing that's gone, you know, to the wayside. There aren't too many of those around town either.
You know, and what Peregrine was alluding to there, I used to work at the Tivoli a long time ago, but I'll say that when I was hired, I was told I would fit right into the dysfunctional little family, and I think that captures a little of that weird spirit you were talking about. Maria, we have talked with you about the Royals winning the World Series. We also have sadder moments we have to face in this discussion. We had some high-profile hate crimes here in the Metro in the last decade, and you wanted to draw our attention to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm specifically thinking about the Jewish Community Center shootings and then the Austin's Bar shooting in Olathe that killed two Indian men. And, you know, and this is not to diminish the homicides, you know, in the rest of Kansas City, Missouri, and, you know, and other places, because that has definitely been a problem. But I also felt that these hate crime shootings and were something a little larger as far as kind of being a little eye-opening to people, as like, this can happen here. This, you know, that I feel like a lot of people in Kansas City are like, well, yeah, there may be people, but not, it's not, no one would take action on it. And so to have not just one, but two, I think has been an eye-opener. And then you've seen all these other little hate crimes. I mean, and not to say any hate crime is little, but, you know, but
without that high profile.
Without that high profile, without that maybe violence of, you know, whether it's, you know, more swastikas being painted places and, you know, just more the John Brown statue. Yeah, the news incident, the John Brown statue being graffitied and then recently had its like hand in a scroll cut off. And, you know, so there have just been more of these, and I think we're more aware of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's hard because I'm like, what does that say about Kansas City? You know,
I think it's easy for us to all get really swept up in this major progress going on, all the buildings going up, all of the people moving in. We feel like we're moving at like, you know, breakneck speed of like into this grandiose time of Kansas City. But I have been noticing it more. And I mean, you know, I was at a sold out event last night looking around and no one looked different than me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, It's easy to forget that we are still steeped in a very racially divided part of the country.
You know, part of it just may be that as there's progress, there's always, you know, that backlash. There's always that, you know, and that these things have just kind of all relates back to the 2016 election in a lot of ways, too, especially with the Austin's Bar shooting, you know, where we're headed as not just a city, but as a nation.
Right.
And the way we talk to each other and think about each other.
Right. And even with great strides in the LGBTQ community, which has made tremendous strides. And Kansas City, I think, is a very open and welcoming place, has a terrible, terrible history of violence against trans persons. There's a murder here at least two or three times a year against a trans person of color.
And you are just reminding me that I believe it was 2017. We, you know, there are all those lists that Kansas City makes that we're all proud of. That was not a proud moment.
No.
This year has been as bad, if not worse, I believe, on that front.
I think you're right. And I'm curious to see. There are places like the Anti-Violence Project that is addressing these problems and other places as well. But yeah, it's part where Kansas City, for all it's doing, is also part of the national epidemic against people.
So, Maria, and you also wanted to talk about a post-recession rebound?
Yeah. I mean, I think this goes into a lot of what Blair's been talking about, just kind of this development boom following the recession. I think we had kind of a collision of things that as I was writing my list, I was like, oh, they all kind of came together. You know, as the recession, as we are kind of coming out of it, the Royals won, you know, and, you know, part of the recession is a lot of things that I think there might have been some appetite for, there wasn't financing for, there wasn't money for. Things were on hold, it felt like, in Kansas City. And as soon as a little bit of that started to become available, you started seeing more. Like, I would drive into parts of the city that I hadn't been to in a few months and I'd be like, what's going on here? And then, you know, the other thing I would highlight on that is the intermodal opening up in, you know, Johnson County, and how kind of as that transportation hub, this is like the development we don't see as much. But Kansas City's become a bigger warehouse distribution center for things. And there's been a lot of these jobs created, you know, in warehouse type jobs where they're not minimum wage jobs. They're not high paying jobs. They're these kind of mid-level jobs that are pretty good. And that's created some of its own problems as far as getting people out to like South Johnson County and these different places where these are centered.
And then one more newsy thing, the right sizing of schools.
Yeah, this one goes back to 2010 when Kansas City closed about half of its schools. And, you know, just because a lot of school or a lot of students were in charter schools and private schools had moved, families had moved out. And it was, you know, the public reckoning there of, you know, like this district isn't what it used to be. And I think people knew that on some level. But then the other thing, you know, soon after the district lost its accreditation, and that really was a moment there of like, oh, I remember talking to a teenager.
That's a moment that's still defining conversations about education here.
Yeah, a student at Paseo, and she's like, what does it mean if I graduate from a high school without accreditation? Like, does it mean I, you know, like just these like very basic questions of what does that say about the education I've gotten? Does that make it legitimate? Am I, you know, or should I feel like I've graduated high school? And, you know, and but that being said, Kansas City's made significant progress since that time. You know, we've been borderline kind of at those scores of getting reaccredited, and just haven't quite gotten there, but there's no
provisional.
There's no comparison between the two, I would say. And, you know, like when it lost accreditation at some point, it felt like it would be, there was no hope of even regaining it. And I think Kansas City school officials have that hope every year now that this is going to be the year that we get fully accredited, we're no longer provisional, and that, you know, we can be seen as a, you know, I think they are largely seen as a legitimate school choice for many families, but, you know, that final mark of approval there.
And that whole conversation about public education in Kansas City, I feel like has really evolved over the past decade.
Yeah, in so many ways. I mean, and this is not to diminish charter schools and all of this. They've continued to open, and, you know, I mean, there's turnover in charter schools, but that they've continued to grow in many, many ways. And so, and the relationship between the charters and the school district has evolved to be less butting heads constantly and a little bit more friendly towards charters from the district.
Okay. You know, we're going to turn to some artsier developments again. That's what our listeners are calling about at 816-235-2888. We're going to get to a couple of those suggestions and then turn back to Carla Deal. Let's hear from Eric in Overland Park. Hi, Eric.
Yeah. Hello. Good morning, guys.
What do you want to share?
Yeah, so just kind of a little interesting nugget. We're talking about kind of what defined the last decade for Kansas City. And really on a national level, I'm about 40 years old, and I've kind of seen the evolution of adult animation. You know, The Simpsons was kind of, you know, the forefront of that. But during my lifetime, we've seen it explode into this huge thing.
When you say adult animation, you just mean like not for kids.
Not for kids, correct. Like, exactly. Kind of moving beyond, really just, again, kind of outside the Simpsons. And kind of something that I'm proud of, and it's I've never really heard it talked about nationally or even locally, is one of the largest animated shows out there right now, Archer, on FXX now, with, of course, H. John Benjamin, which a lot of people might know from Bob's Burgers. But there's actually an animation studio called Trinity Animation Studios, and it actually does all the backgrounds for the show Archer, which is known for its very, very unique. It's a gorgeous-looking show, and that's all due to Trinity Animation, located there in Overland Park. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe they also did the Adult Swim show, Lucy, Daughter of the Devil, which was also H. John Benjamin and Lauren Bouchard, which do Bob's Burgers together. So something that's kind of awesome for animation fans to know.
Well, thanks, Eric. We have a lot of nodding going on in this studio right now.
Well, the interactive arts have really come to maturity, and it's nice to see that the Kansas City Art Institute is offering a lot more activity in that realm. A friend of mine, Kevin Heckert, who had a show at the Whitney a million years ago, has decided to return to Kansas City Art Institute for interactive art. So it's nice that there are these artists who are just not it's a new discipline that's being introduced into the zeitgeist, which is kind of great. And I'm glad to see that Kansas City is keeping up and participating in it in a really meaningful way.
Okay, and let's quickly talk to Jake in Kansas City. Hi, Jake.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about? What defined the decade?
I wanted to share, I think, one of the biggest successes Kansas City, Missouri had in the last 10 years was to become designated as the only city of music recognized by UNESCO's Creative City Network, which we accomplished in 2017.
Yeah, talk to me about this, Carla.
Well, it is. It's such an unknown. Hey, Jake. That's awesome that he called in. he was elemental in making that happen. But it's Kansas City is one of the only in the nation, and nobody really knows that. And it's something to celebrate. And we bring in a lot of amazing musical acts because of that. So that should be way more on the forefront.
Carla, what else is on your list that we haven't talked about?
I want to say that I'm so happy that the younger generations are really stepping up and creating these massive leaps and bounds in culture and art in our city. And just a overview highlight of some of those. In 2017, the Spray C. Moe Mural Festival came to Kansas City, and that's originated by founder Jason Harrington, better known as Riff Raff Giraffe.
We talked to him on the show about it.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, you know what? There's about 80 murals that are huge on all the buildings in the East Crossroads that he alone has made happen by bringing in artists. So, I can't wait to see what more that does. There's also Orpheus Affair. It was the biggest event that the Young Friends of the Lyric, they're now called Orpheus KC, they brought in. They sold it out. They made a lot of money. They had larger than life art installations that were interactive. This is going to my take on this event is that it will be the number one party to go to in Kansas City, and it's coming up in this summer.
Okay, what else?
Another huge thing that's happened in 2017 was that the Jackson County Historical Society acquired the Wilborn Photographic Collection. This might not sound like it's too meaningful, but these are 500,000 undeveloped, never-before-seen photos of Kansas City from 1921 to 2007. And it will be the largest regional collection ever acquired of Kansas City seen through the decades. And I just, every single day that they develop them, they're finding more interesting things, and it will be a huge, huge impact on the city.
Okay, and do you have one more, or does that wrap it up for you?
I can keep going, Gina.
Okay, one last one.
Okay, one of my favorite things that have come out is a film by David Wayne Reed called
Our next guest on this show.
It's called Eternal Harvest, and it will move you. From the Midwest, you know, he went out on his family's farm, his family's seventh generation in Lewisburg, Kansas. He filmed it on his family's farm with drones, and he used his grandmother's quilts and turned them into these beautiful mandalas. I say that it has the heart of the Midwest and the soul of India, and it will take you through a whole journey of life and death just through imagery on the farm.
Okay. Blair Schulman, what's left on your list? We'll just jog through these before we welcome David Wayne Reed.
Okay, very good. Running backwards to 2009, Cody Critchlow, who was the founder of a local and art music collective called Shun, was a very, very big deal in the late aughts. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we'll call it.
And that's Shun, S-S-I-O-N.
That's right. Redemption, confusion, all those things. He had a film that was financed by the late Gallery Grand Arts, which was an amazing space for art and culture. It was a film that was helped bring a queer slash weird perspective and put them on an international scale. And I think it was one of the jumping off points for how Kansas City can emote itself in a strangely significant way that allowed others to do strange things.
Which, if you think about that, that's also the story in a very different way of Janelle Monáe, not in such a cult way. I mean, in just a big way.
Right, exactly. And by the way, Cody is in town tonight and performing at Record Bar, so go see him. He's still a great person, and Shun is just crazy and weird and wonderful. And to bookend it, I want to talk about Alter, which was founded by Boy Boy and Bo Hubbard. They were a collaborative, multidisciplinary art space that was funded by the Charlotte Street Foundation's Rocket Grant and Meow Wolf, and they spent a year to provide a space with installation, performance, art, and painting, and brought music and actors. And
okay, I'm so sorry, but we'll remember that. We'll pick up with that sometime next year. Maria Carter, Carla Deal, Blair Schulman, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next on Central Standard, a one-man show takes on a giant or two. It's called Goliath. That's in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and David Wayne Reed is a fixture in Kansas City's theater scene. His last one-man show was called The Jolly Rancher. It was a series of true vignettes from his life about growing up artsy and gay in rural Kansas and learning to let those seemingly contradictory aspects of his identity coexist in harmony and hilariousness. And now David's out with a new one-man show. It's called Goliath, and it debuts between Christmas and New Year's. David, hello.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me on. I'm still giddy. I heard my name mentioned in the green room. I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. That was really great. Really great.
What is Goliath about? I would think, since you are David, it would have to do with a giant foe that you have battled.
Yes. It is a series of underdog stories of biblical proportions. And in those, you know, often I am the David, and sometimes I am my own Goliath.
Dang.
And I think that's probably true for most of us.
Yeah, I'm for sure for
And
me.
How those, you know, you mentioned about Jolly Rancher, about how two seemingly disparate things can coexist. And I think I'm continuing with that, about how we all are David and Goliath.
So when you, just one of the stories I know that you're putting out there has to do with your feelings about the band Wham.
Talk
to me about Wham.
I'm so glad you asked about Wham.
And Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
Well, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go was an epiphany to me. I mean, that was just a blast of lightning out of the sky and really kind of showed me a way forward. I was on a family trip that my dad had won from our Chamber of Commerce to go to Panama City Beach. And we were on this really great trip. And then I heard it. You know, the opening strains of Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. And it was like anachronistic. And it was just like something I'd never heard before. And I wanted
How old were you at this time?
I was 12.
And we're going to set for, because we don't know, our listeners could be any age out there.
Sure.
You know, like, say, what year are we talking about?
We're talking about 1984.
Okay, so tell me more about the, like, cultural moment and the musical moment in which Wham makes this impression.
Well, it was under a conservative presidency. I mean, it was around the time of Reagan, Just Say No, a nuclear arms race, AIDS. You know, there were a lot of really big, big ticket kind of items hitting the mainstream and our consciousness.
It was also a very, like, I think this is maybe weird to say, but kind of a preppy moment.
Yeah, preppy conservative kind of time. But also in the backlash of that, there was a lot of sexual fluidity hitting the mainstream through music with Madonna, with Wham, with, of course, Boy George and Culture Club. And it was like that first shock of recognition with me that it's like, I feel different. And I think these guys might be like me, even though I had no idea really what that meant. And it happened around the time in junior high when we're all developing, and that was the first time I was called an F word, which is another name for a homosexual, and I didn't know what that meant. And so bullies called me that, and so it was a moment of real identification on both sides of the aisle for me.
So that story is part of what you'll be addressing. Can you tell me a story where you are Goliath?
I think my behaviors that I exhibited were Goliath, and one of those was drinking. Drinking was a big Goliath for me. And also smoking cigarettes. I've got a really funny story. I quit drinking and smoking while working for a gay cruise company. And I quit smoking on a gay cruise to Alaska, and I quit drinking right before a gay cruise to the Caribbean. And just in that context, it provides a really funny juxtaposition of two very different ways of being, I guess.
When you think about the idea, I mean, this is, you put in the sort of tagline that it's a struggle of biblical proportions. Can you talk to me about what biblical proportions mean to you?
Oh, I think, you know, just really big life-changing stories, stories that change our trajectory, stories that include a hero's journey. And I think most of us, we're our own hero in our own journey. And this is just my own.
What's your sense of where Jolly Rancher left off and where Goliath picks up? Is this sort of a continuation of that story? And if so, like, what is the bigger story here, and where does one become the other?
Well, I think they slide seamlessly into one another because, you know, I guess I'm the hero of that hero's journey. I think that Jolly Rancher was really about self-acceptance and letting go. And I think this one is about slaying your demons and getting real with your weaknesses, as well as finding your strengths as a result of those weaknesses.
Would you be willing to share one more of these vignettes with us, just as a little teaser? That we've talked about your experience with Wham, and we've talked a little bit about your journey towards sobriety. Mm-hmm. What about one more?
Well, you know, one of the things, talking about Kansas City and things that happened in the last decade that really shaped it, I know that something that really shaped Kansas City and my decade growing up in the 80s was the movie The Day After. And seeing that really messed me up for a really long time, because those things happen on the nightly news, or those things happen in other parts of the world.
For people who don't know what you're talking
about. It was a nuclear disaster that happened right here in Kansas City, Missouri. And it was right around a time of some heavy bullying for me, as well as, my own sexual genesis in junior high. And all of that coming together was really terrifying, and coming out from under that. And, you know, I've had many terrible day afters since then. But every day you wake up and it's a new day. And, you know, there'll be future day afters, but we will continue on. And that's one of the stories. It's a little bit more hilarious than maybe I've told.
But that only more hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the recurring themes here has to do with, I mean, bullying has come up several times. Mm. Is that something that we can just, like, address a little bit more? Like, that this seems to be a reckoning with having been bullied and the way that that has had reverberations throughout your life.
Well, sure. I mean, I was thinking about that on the way in. You know, yes, I was bullied growing up, and it was pretty rough. And I have a story about going to Pride in D.C. in the year 2000. And I remember a guy I grew up with who was also called the same that I was called. We went to the March on Washington together. And even though we had left those bullies in Lewisburg, Kansas, far behind, there were new bullies. And they were the Phelps Klan that were lining the streets. And, you know, bullies don't really go away. I mean, they grow up and they become they become politicians. They become president. And, you know, we always have to slay that we always have to work to find our inner David and slay that, whether that's on, you know, our home turf or that's on election 2020 or beyond. You know, there's always a Goliath. There's always a David.
Your choice to use a biblical story as the sort of framing metaphor for this show is an interesting choice to me. And I wonder if you can talk about what that means to you on a deeper level.
About, I'm sorry, repeat the question.
What biblical stories mean to you, or what, your relationship with, is this a religious story?
Well, it is. I mean, my story definitely starts in the church. And when, that's my first story. When I was little and in Vacation Bible School, I went to the Ford dealership in Lewisburg, Kansas. Salute. And it was a really hot day, and I was hot, and so I got too close to a fan.
As one is on a hot day.
And I stuck my hands close to this open squirrel cage fan, and it cut off all the tips of my fingers. And when I was four, and I still had to complete Vacation Bible School, and I remember standing with like these kind of hamburger helper style glove mitts on both of my hands. And I couldn't feed myself. I couldn't go to the bathroom by myself for months until my hands healed. And I'm standing up at the end of the program singing, "Jesus loves me, this I know." And, you know, you're like, do you? Is this? I don't know. What? And that was like the first kind of reckoning. And I remember back then I'm screaming like, "Jesus, Jesus, Lord, help me, Jesus." And when people would ask me, "Why did I do that? Why'd you stick your hands in the fan?" I'd be like, "The devil made me do it." And my understanding at that point was very, you know, you ask for Jesus when you need help and you blame the devil when you've done something wrong, and kind of reckoning between those polarities. That's what religion, that's how it appeared to me in the very beginning.
Where are you on that journey now?
I am probably more of a salad bar Buddhist.
Salad bar Buddhist. What does that mean? I think I know, you know, but I'm curious.
I'll have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. You know, I kind of have an amalgam of spiritual beliefs. My daily ritual is a 20-minute meditation every day. So, I mean, that's my, I guess, my spiritual life.
But then with David and Goliath is just this bigger idea of there being something larger than you that you can still conquer.
There is something so larger than me that I can still conquer. And, you know, I may not know what it is yet, but I'm sure it will reveal itself to me in no time. It always does.
You know, the timing of this performance, that it opens between Christmas and New Year's, that's a hard time to get people in a theater. Like, I wonder if there is a significance to the timing of this theatrical debut.
There is. You know, I wanted to leave a lot of these stories behind in this decade. And so I wanted to get it out and move on to greener creative pastures in the next decade. And really, you know, let those stories live and die with the decade. That's what it is. As far as the timing of it, I think it's actually a good time for people to get out and see the show. You've spent all that time cooped up with your family. You're ready to get the hell out of town, out of the family's house, and go do something. And so I think it's a perfectly reasonable time.
I think it's a perfectly reasonable time, too. I was just curious about the significance. I also think about the significance in terms of sobriety being one of the main touchstones of the story you're telling, and that this is a hard time of year for a lot of people to stay sober.
This is a hard time. There are so many triggers, so many impetuses. I quit drinking 6 years ago on December 15th. So I know what that is, but I think it's also a good time to be, if you do have a problem. I don't want to characterize my show as being preachy. Like, I'm not some Carry Nation. I don't care if you drink. But if you do have a problem, you know, and identify with that story, you know, maybe it's a good time to really have some introspection and make a change as you go into the new year.
Do you have a New Year's resolution, David Wainwright?
I do. I'm giving up drive-through.
Whoa.
Yeah. I should have given that up a long time ago. I'm embarrassed to even say that, but that's my resolution.
Okay. Well, good luck on that one.
Thank you.
And I'll see you at your show.
Thanks, Gina.
David Wainwright, thank you so much for being here
today. Absolutely.
Goliath opens December 27th and runs through January 4th. It's at a venue called Capsule. You can get all the info at Brown Paper Tickets online. And that is a wrap for today, but we'll have both of these discussions available for you at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can go back and hear our conversation with Reverend Eric Williams if you missed that a couple days back. He is the Baptist minister here in town whose ministry tends to HIV and AIDS education and support. Tomorrow, tune in for a food show. We pushed it back for impeachment coverage last week, so we will be coming to the table very hungry for mac and cheese. We will also talk kids' menus and lunch counters. That's lunch counters past and present, right as Michael Corvino revives that old concept. That and more tomorrow at 10. Talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.